This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
The Drew Mariani Show. On Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. Drew's taking a few days off. Everybody needs that. And he'll be back at the end of the week. I'm Sheeta Lagminas filling in the meantime. And wow, what a loaded show. How fast this goes, as Drew always says. How fast it always goes. So just a few moments ago, I was talking to a guest who teaches through classic films and right and wrong and morality and truth and the natural law. And it was really interesting when she was talking about culture, the difference culture makes. And even in 12 Angry Men, that's a classic film she was kind of finishing on. And the culture certainly has a great impact. Let's just say a tremendous, huge impact. Not great in some ways, but huge impact on how people think. And then thinking, once it sort of gets set in your mind, leads to actions, doesn't it? And thinking's been changed a lot by the use of words, the use of language, the media use of that love language, and also by those culture power brokers who promote things with slick marketing that really does change enough people's thinking that then that starts to build and grow it on momentum. And then other people change accordingly, thinking, well, I don't want to be out of the mainstream. I don't want to be uncharitable towards others. And that's the way things are pushed. Abortion. Don't you care about, you know, women in a crisis pregnancy? Yes. That's why there are so many pregnancy help centers, more than abortion clinics even, in this country. They care for the women and their babies. So that's how much we do care. We care about the truth of the human person, human flourishing, the search for happiness, what that constitutes. That search just continues to snowball. The more people go for things and find that they don't find happiness there, so go for more. And they're never happy. Well, on these topics, you're hearing a lot about transgenderism. Not a lot of it's calm, not a lot of it's charitable. A lot of it's either bullying or just ideologically based. And you want to be able to talk about it or deal with it in ways you need to, because it's kind of everywhere. School curricula now, across the board. It's in on lower levels all the way through junior high, high school. It's there. It's turning up trans in people in sports, and then locker room issues and bathroom issues and so many issues. There's a bill in Louisiana that would ban biological males from playing in girls' sports. Such bans have been passed in other states, and it was actually passed in the Pelican State, but Governor John Bel Edwards vetoed it. He said the bill was, quote, was a solution in search of a problem that simply does not exist in Louisiana, close quote. The bill's author acknowledged there hasn't been a single case of that happening yet, but the state Senate voted yesterday to override the veto. It now goes back to the state House for a veto override vote. So as they work through that next door in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott has said he'll be taking action soon to replicate a bill that failed in the regular session because of the Democrats who failed to show up to complete the session. That bill would disallow hormone therapy, puberty suppressants, and transition-related surgeries for minors that couldn't pass. But Governor Abbott says he'll be able to implement the same thing through other means, and he's going to announce them later in the week. Then, in California, a state appeals court panel has unanimously ruled in favor of those who brought a suit against a law that requires nursing home employees to use the names and pronouns the residents prefer. If they don't allow the law, that allows for the employees to be charged with a misdemeanor and fined up to $1,000 or even face a year in jail. Can you imagine that? That's where we are. According to the Daily Wire, the court said that requirement is a content-based restriction of speech that does not survive strict scrutiny and, quote, burdens speech more than is required. Well, here to parse these things apart is Walt Heyer, a man whose story reflects our society's confusion on gender identity. Walt grew up wanting to be a girl, went through the transition, and then found after several years of identifying as a woman that that didn't address his pain. It only covered it. So he transitioned back to male. Walt now mentors others who want to transition back. You can find out more at Walt Heyer, H-E-Y-E-R.com, or sexchangeregret.com. Walt.com. Well, I was going to say, welcome, Walt, or Walt, welcome. So welcome, Walt, to the program. Yeah. Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Alliteration,
my pleasure.
Right?
Thanks for
being
here.
Right.
Yeah, that's all right. Nice to be on with you.
You as well, because, you know, we need informed opinions of these things, and also not just opinions, mm-hmm. but insights. And Walt, you certainly bring insights. You bring personal insights. So your thoughts on these different bills, Louisiana, Texas, and California, what are your thoughts on all of them?
Well, what's interesting about all these bills is that they all assume that a man can change into a woman or a woman can change into a man. And so the basis for all of these arguments is the idea that people, quote, transition and become transgender. Now, if you're speaking from a biological point of view, we know that is categorically impossible. So if from a biological point of view, no one in the history of mankind has ever biologically changed from man to woman or woman to man. So the next phase is, can you medically and surgically, quote, transition? And the answer is no. No amount of hormones, no amount of surgery can actually change your gender, sex, from male to female or female to male. So we have then the scientific component, which comprises all your hormones and genes and so forth, and those are not changed either. So the problem that exists is people who apparently don't understand that no one actually changes from one gender to the other. So the people that are fighting these laws and saying, you know, a man can't compete in women's sports because they're men. And so a woman's sport requires that you be a woman, not a man identifying as a woman. An example of that was when I was in my 40s and I was taking some college courses at a college, and they had a tennis class, and I took the tennis class. And in my 40s, in the tennis class, I was playing against girls in the girls' arena who were in their early 20s. I never lost a match. Many of them couldn't even retrieve the ball when I hit it. So the men who identify as women are not women, and they are going to crush the opposition. And many of the men who want to identify as women do so because they can crush the competition and people are allowing. They shouldn't be allowed to be in women's sports. They're men. And so therein lies the real issues. And the pronoun thing that they're talking about, California, is even more interesting because I have mastered the art, and you can practice doing this, is that if you're sitting with somebody or talking to somebody, you never use their pronouns. So I've mastered this art of talking to someone for hours and never using their pronouns. I'm talking to you. I'm not using pronouns. You can go through. The only time you actually use pronouns is when the person is not in your presence.
Yeah, third person.
And you're talking about them when they're, you're talking about them, or he or she was in my office. In this legislation thing, and Abbott is right to not want young people to have hormone suppressing. Those drugs were never intended for the purpose of helping people transition. Those drugs were designed and made for young children who whose puberty was too aggressive. They were rapidly increasing too much, and so they were designed to suppress it and normalize it. Now the people who advocate using this for kids are taking a drug not intended for the purpose that it was designed for and trying to use it to stop the suppression, and so that they can introduce hormones of the opposite gender to them at a later date. The problem is that the suppressants are actually harmful to people who don't have advanced or aggressive puberty. And so this whole thing is built on the fact that back in 1997, 78, 78, doctors were starting surgeries at a clinic, and one doctor, Dr. Charles L. Illenfeld, had worked 6 years helping 500 people transition. And he was an endocrinologist, so he was the one administering hormones after the surgery. He worked with them, and he came to the conclusion, in his own words, he's a homosexual activist, and he said that he is leaving the practice of giving hormones to these individuals. These were adults, because he said it's causing too many of them to commit suicide.
Oh, boy. And then so all the more, all the more tender-walled adolescents.
Right. So, you know, there is no good history, and I've written about this in my books, Trans Life Survivors, Paper Genders, and people can go online and certainly look at my books, buy my books if you're interested, because they tell the story that the harm that's done, and I get those emails almost every day from people. I had somebody, a teacher who transitioned, quote, transitioned in October, contacted me about 2 weeks ago and said he regrets having done it. How do I get my body parts back? My life is ruined.
Oh,
he's an adult. They tell you that this is going to fix your problems, and it doesn't. And people are only transgender until they stop identifying transgender, and people need to understand that the harm that's done is overwhelming. I mean, an 18-year-old who transitioned right when he was 18 because his parents gave him approval for the blockers at 15. He took the blockers till he was 18, had surgery just after his 18th birthday. He contacted me on his 19th birthday and said, I feel like a Frankenstein monster. Walt, can you help me? That article is in the Daily Signal under my name, and it's Nathaniel. These stories come up all the time. And so if we can talk about the harm, it's much more interesting than talking about the laws that are trying to prevent the harm.
Well, exactly. And that's what the debate is over. And that's what the anger is over. And that's what the push is over. And yeah, what we really need to talk about are the individuals. Also with your work, Walt, I want people to know Walt Heyer, HEYER.com. You can find, as he said, his books there and information about him. Churches can benefit a great deal from learning how to respond to transgender people in their midst, whether adults or, as we're talking about right now, younger people, and especially minors, because there's so much pressure out there for the culture to embrace transgenderism and almost, in such a way, in embracing it, promoting it just like, same-sex marriage and so forth. Promoting it as a choice you might want to consider because you might just be one of those people who feel, you know, that you're trapped in the wrong body, whatever is said. So unfortunately, you're giving us example after example of people who have done that. We're in the case of adolescents, there's so much confusion at that age anyway. So if a child starts getting hormonal treatment and then decides after, because this is a child, adolescent, and then decides after a year or two that he or she doesn't like it or is confused or is panicky, can it be reversed? Is there a point of no return?
Well, the female who wants to identify as a male, if they start taking male hormones, and this is where I will say the greatest tragedy occurs. Every woman who takes female hormones will have things they cannot reverse. Their voice will still sound like a man. And I've got this with my friend Sydney, and she detransitioned, but she says, Walt, I still sound like a man. When will this go away? Well, it's not going to go away. There's, you know, facial features. You'll start to grow a beard. And there's all these things begin to happen. And, the depression that comes after women have gone through these hormonal treatments and can't quickly reverse what they found to be abhorrent to them and a big mistake is traumatizing. And so men will fare better with the hormones, although it will take them several years for the hormones to lose the effect they had, but if they've had bottom surgery. There's nothing you can do about reversing the surgical procedure they have there. So, with children, especially young children now, what we don't have gender dysphoria. What we have is a social contagion. Kids are doing this because their friends are doing it, or because they're online, or because I had one young person write me and said, I needed friends, and I felt like an outcast. Once I identified as a transgender, I had all kinds of friends, but I don't want to be a transgender anymore. So sometimes they're doing this just to gain access to a friendship group, whether it's online or at school or with their friends. You have automatic approval if you identify as a transgender. I think this is the hideous part of this, because no one talks about this word that I mention every time I have an opportunity, is consequences. They don't understand the serious consequences of engaging in the use of medical treatments, including the hormones. Many of these girls are having their breasts taken off at 12 and 13 years old. And the doctors who do it say, well, you can just have breast implants if you change your mind. Well, why are we even having a conversation with a child who may want to reverse what the doctor did? I mean, this to me is insanity. And I think it's harmful. I think it's abuse of medical practice. I call it the greatest medical fraud in history to say a doctor tells someone, I can change your gender sex. You can't do it. And yet we're celebrating doctors who do this. And we're celebrating the people who go through the change as though they're something special, that they're brave. I wish the doctors would tell the truth. And this is what I was just at a conference in Louisiana just a few days ago. And the people you can see when you talk the truth, they stand up with a standing ovation. They want to hear the truth. People want the truth. We're tired of being lied to. We're tired of being manipulated. We're tired of being told what pronouns to use. We don't want them in women's sports. If you're a woman, you should be in women's sports. If you're a man, I don't care if you're wearing a dress. You know, wear a dress in men's sports. That's your business. But the fact of the matter is, you're still a man whether you're wearing a dress or not. You're still a man if you've had women's hormones. You're still a man if you had your penis cut off. You're still a man. Nothing changes. I have a document that proves that, where the surgeon who does the surgery admitted in San Mateo, California Superior Court, that no surgery at any time has ever changed a man into a woman, not hormonally and not surgically. So why are we having a discussion about something that you cannot do?
That's my question. There you go. That's direct, Walt. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Walt Heyer, a man whose story reflects our society's confusion on gender identity. In spite of what you see celebrated out there and see promoted and marketed, and it's in commercials now even. I'm seeing it more often. Walt grew up wanting to be a girl, went through the transition, found after several years of identifying as a woman that didn't address his pain. It only covered it. So he transitioned back to male and now mentors others who want to transition back. You can find out his information, his books, his writings at WaltHeyer.com or SexChangeRegret.com. And as I said earlier, one of the things you'll see on his site is how the churches can benefit from learning how to respond to transgender people in their midst. And I was thinking about that, Walt, because we in the Catholic Church teaches we really want to advance, promote, and celebrate human flourishing. We want to celebrate the human person. Even biblically, I know people don't want to hear this in that world, but God made them male and female. So when we celebrate that, when we want the fully integrated human being, and integrated really does, bring in a lot, but it helps us to flourish. It helps others to flourish. We want that in our parishes, in our society, in our citizenry. And how do we do that? When we have this marketing and celebration of first one ideological thing like same-sex marriage, and then it moves on to Pride Month and Pride parades everywhere, and then transgenderism now being a much bigger thing that is, turning up in commercials I'm seeing on TV. I did a double take when I saw one recently. I thought, wait, is that person in that they're featuring in this commercial? It seems like it's a man, now a woman looking.
Right.
And that's what it was. And in the end, it was a job interview, and the man doing the interviewing very, you know, gently and respectfully asked, let me start with, what would you like to be called? Meaning pronoun. So.
Right.
And it just, it brought relief to the moment. And that person just let out a sigh and said, thank you for asking. And it's making the culture more ready to accept this. And yet you're saying, you know, of course, the harm, you know, that's done out there. So, and you even said kids are either pushed, bullied, or just having peer pressure by for being physically altered, with minors not even allowed to get, as I understand it, a Tylenol at school without their parents' permission, then why are we allowing them, or is anybody allowing them, to have these life-altering treatments without their parents knowing it? How did it get that far?
Well, you know, if we're intellectually honest about this, we can look to Sweden, which is a very liberal country, who keeps track of all the medical treatments that are involved. They will not any longer give kids hormone treatments until they're 18 years old. No blockers, no anything, because they've seen the medical effects through all of the everybody in Sweden is on a medical plan that the government runs. So they keep all the records. They see the harm that's being done. They also say that the people who are, quote, transitioning, which no one really transitions, but that's the word they use, you are 19 times more likely to die by suicide than if you didn't. That's Sweden. That's not Waldheim. I'm not making this up. It's in their research. This research is like 33 years in the making, so it's not something they just came up with. There's an actual fact here. When the sperm hits the egg, you can't change anything. That's the big boom is right there. Gender and sex is fixed, innate and unchangeable, but they want to use this word, your sex and gender is assigned at birth. How absolute crazy that is. Nobody assigns your gender at birth. It's fixed at conception. The idea they use that assigned at birth because then they say, well, if it was assigned at birth, now we can unassign it later. That's why they use this terminology. And I saw Eli Lilly, I think it was, and in their commercial, it says you are randomly assigned your gender. In the that's false. It's a lie.
Well, Walt, you're telling it like it is. At conception, a new human life is present, and that human life is either male or female. Walt Heyer, you do such a good job. WaltHeyer, HEYER.com. I know you have a lot of things to address. Thank you for coming in today to address these laws and issues in across the country. Thanks so much, Walt.
The Drew Mariani Show.
You're talking about it on radio.
Here for you.
You're providing awareness to your audience.
On Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Lagbenis. Drew's out for a few days. I'm in for Drew. And this show has been packed each day with great guests. I continue to have a really important set of topics to talk to with a very good guest at front and center of the United Nations, watching what they're up to there. There are very good actors doing good things, you know, taking actions at the United Nations, and there are those who are pushing ideological agenda there. And CFAM is always on that, the Center for Family and Human Rights. They really need our support. Read what they write. They have a small team there in Manhattan. They're close to the United Nations, and they're on top of what's happening there, and then they let us know. In these really fine articles, things you don't even hear in the other media. Well, the United Nations has always been sort of a hotbed of strange ideas and the latest cultural fads. And you may not know that because, you know, it has its reputation, right? Going back to the UN Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I featured that, the preamble of that, in my book because it's so beautifully written about the inherent human rights of inalienable rights of all human beings. It's just, please, UN, read your own preamble again. But, you know, the latest fads that they can be prone to, or some activists there, are of what remains of Western culture. You're not going to see the traditional support for family structures present on the African continent or in many other countries around the world making an official appearance at the United Nations. It's not featured there. That faddish agenda of some activists at the United Nations includes, of course, trying to get abortion imposed in every country around the world, and they've been at this for a very long time. Apparently also, not just around the world, trying to get every country around the world to take in the whole LGBT agenda. The United Nations Human Rights Council recently had a meeting, and the agenda was dominated by abortion, and trying to say there are sexual rights even for minors. Stefano Generini is vice president for the Center of Legal Studies at the Center for Family and Human Rights, CFAM. You can find them online at c-fam.org. Stefano, thanks for being here. I love talking with you. It's been a while.
Thanks, Sheila. Thanks for having me again.
Well, here we are talking about abortion activism at the United Nations. Stefano, I don't know, is it always ramping up? Does it always stay sort of at a high level of activism or what?
Well, it's been pretty constant for the last 40, 50 years, and especially the last 30 years. But the surprising thing, Sheila, is that despite the amazing amount of money that has been spent on promoting abortion internationally, as well as LGBT rights, there has been limited success in the actual official documents of the United Nations, you know, the ones that are negotiated and agreed by member states. But where the activists have had a lot of success in promoting abortion and LGBT rights is through the UN bureaucracy, which is really not so much governed, although it should be, by the agreements negotiated and adopted by member states, but more by donor states, that is, the powerful countries, powerful Western countries who fund most of the United Nations.
Yeah, and unfortunately, to tell our listeners how prominent the United States features in that.
Well, it depends on who's in the White House, largely. We saw that there was a very strong push for to establish or open a way towards an international right to abortion in the Clinton years, in the Obama years, and we're now seeing it through the Biden administration. We had a surprisingly very good period under the Trump administration where several of his political nominees at all levels of the administration, within HHS, within the State Department, ambassadors as well, who made very good interventions at the United Nations against an international right to abortion. But we were still always facing resistance from the entrenched bureaucrats who tend to lean left on these social issues, sadly. And they tended to defend the positions that were taken under the previous Democrat administration. So the progress that we made was limited, although there were unprecedented pro-life actions under the Trump administration because of so many good nominees.
It's true. It's so interesting. In one of your latest articles, Abortion and LGBT Debates at the 47th Session of the Human Rights Council, you note, Stefano, that the UN experts and mandate holders disingenuously attempt to manufacture new international rights related to abortion and LGBT issues that were never internationally agreed by states. That's also somewhat known among diplomats who interface with the United Nations. But the extent and the vituperation with which UN mechanisms go about doing this remains for the most part hidden. So if not for CFAM, we wouldn't know that much about it. So you say that's evident in the lack of occasions on which UN member states have attempted to hold UN mandate holders accountable. Who's holding them accountable at all?
Well, aside from the few organizations that we work with, a team of, you know, pro-life organizations, pro-life, pro-family organizations, there's very few people, very few diplomats internationally who are holding the UN system accountable. And that's largely a function of the fact that most countries that are socially conservative tend to also be on the receiving end of a lot of international aid. Because they are on the receiving end of international aid, it becomes very hard for them to sort of poke their finger in the eye of the person who's also, you know, giving them assistance. Mm-hmm. The powerful countries who fund the UN agenda, including the abortion and LGBT agenda, therefore they will rarely stick out their necks and anger their donors. When they do, it is usually because of something very egregious. And we've had several occasions in recent months where that's happened with regards to the LGBT agenda, as well as with regards to abortion. Recently at the Human Rights Council, we saw a wonderful development where several member states, including all the member states of the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, which are 54 UN member states, as well as other countries individually, made statements reprimanding a UN group called the Working Group on Discrimination Against Women in Law and Practice, which is a group of five UN experts who often pronounce themselves on events, political events, political developments with regards to women's rights anywhere in the world. So they essentially interfere in the internal affairs of any member state. Often they'll comment on pending legislation. They will comment on pending judicial decisions, which is highly inappropriate if you think about it, because one of the principles of the UN Charter is non-interference in the internal affairs of states. But in any case, this Working Group on Discrimination Against Women in Law and Practice is very aggressive in promoting abortion. And in their latest report, they also promoted a right to abortion in humanitarian settings, including during the COVID pandemic. And several member states, as I was saying, including the entire Organization for Islamic Cooperation, made up of 54 UN member states, objected to this report when the working group reported to the Human Rights Council last month.
Wow. So, I mean, discrimination against women in law and practice sounds good. And then you realize this is many things in the House of Representatives when there's a bill that's set up to do one thing. I mean, to address one need or one area. And then all these things are slipped into it. And when you really read it, it can't pass the vote doesn't pass, or the vote does pass, but against, say, pro-lifers, because it slipped into it the elimination of the Hyde Amendment. In other words, that goes on in politics. That goes on at the United Nations, but then that's riddled with politics too. So, but to that point, I'm fascinated by it. Long have been. Many people are fascinated by the UN and have followed it for a long time. But Stefano, for our listeners right now, coast to coast, thinking of what's in their minds and on their minds, just to answer what many people may be thinking about, for a lot of people in the U.S., the UN, United Nations, is basically kind of, it's there, but it's kind of a non-entity. So it doesn't impact their lives at all, they don't think. So there's so much else that does. So that, therefore, the thought may be, why should we be concerned with what happens there? What would you tell them?
Well, I'll start with some practical information that and recent events that might help to understand how influential the United Nations is. For example, this whole transgender mania that has enveloped the entirety of Western society, it didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, the place where it was legitimized, the place where it found a foothold first, was in the United Nations. I don't know if any of your listeners would be familiar, possibly some of them will be, but with the Beijing Women's Conference in 1995, the Fourth World Conference of Women, all the transgender agenda was already being brought in back then. And John Paul II was alerted to it. A wonderful Catholic woman researcher, her name is Dale O'Leary. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
I remember her.
She worked a lot on this issue, exposing this issue. And sadly, you know, the world didn't listen. And now we find ourselves 25 years later, and children are being taken away from their parents because they're not being allowed to transition. So, you know, the United Nations does have a lot of influence. And many people don't understand how influential it actually is, because they view everything the United Nations does is through a very legalistic lens, which is simply saying, oh, well, let's just see what the United Nations does that is binding. Well, in actual fact, there is very little that comes through the United Nations that is binding. All the agreements that UN member states make through the United Nations, for the most part, are are not binding on states, but they are binding on the UN system. And the UN system administers, you know, $50 billion of international assistance every year. And that's very influential, especially in countries that are very poor, where that money has a lot of influence. So, and moreover, it's also influential on us, because all these UN experts, you know, who pronounce themselves and pontificate about, you know, U.S. abortion laws and LGBT rights around the world. Whereas, you know, from a legal standpoint, you know, many conservatives will say, oh, well, but that's not legally binding, so we can just ignore that. Well, in actual fact, everybody in academia, everybody in the media, and the whole world, aside from a small niche of conservatives, actually consider them as authoritative and even binding at times. So they are very influential, and they are a real threat to self-government and our authentic human rights.
So considered as legally binding, is even though they're not, it reminds me, Stefano, of the saying, or the truism, that even the perception of an impropriety is itself an impropriety. So therefore, the perception of a legally binding belief or a proclamation at the United Nations, though it's not legally binding, becomes almost de facto restrictive, at least to those who think, oh, I can't do that, or I can't believe this, or I can't act on this or say this, because that's legally binding now by the United Nations, though it's not. Is that right?
Yes. So technically speaking, in law, there's a principle called ex injuria jus non oritur. I'm sorry to cite Latin, but it basically means you cannot have law cannot arise from an attack on the law or an injury against the law. So an illegality cannot result in a legality. So you could apply that principle to what UN human rights mandate holders are doing and UN agencies are doing. But on the other hand, it's a principle that, you know, of law that is very abstract and isn't generally applied everywhere. What really happens is, and this is an anecdote that I heard first from Piero Tozzi, who was who's a lawyer who now leads the Lantos Commission in Congress.
Oh,
And he once described it, saying that the way customary international law develops is like this. If I were to tell you, you know, I'm the emperor of China, would you believe me? Of course not. But if the New York Times and CNN and the Wall Street Journal and the human rights procedures and every other academic in the world were to say it, then you would start to believe it. And in a sense, you know, perception is reality. And we are seeing that with the United Nations. We are seeing them try to do this with transgender rights. Including, you know, saying that they've come to the point now of saying that changing one's identity to whatever sex or gender one prefers based on subjective preference is a fundamental principle of human rights. That's what they're calling it, a fundamental principle of human rights. You know, it's in some ways you can say a lot of what the human rights system is doing on these controversial social issues is propaganda, but it's very effective propaganda.
Yeah, that would be. I mean, when that's an excellent point you make about. In another way, I've seen it written in. Joseph Pieper? I think he didn't write Public Opinion. Walter Lippmann used to be a government propagandist way, way, way back. But his book Public Opinion talks about that. When you say something, how it's put out in media, how they cast it, is going to affect how people think about it. Real quick before we get away from that point, just remind people again, with the United Nations Human Rights Council doing all of this activist work on abortion agenda and LGBT agenda, Stefano, remind listeners which countries are on the Human Rights Council. How many?
So there's 48 member states of the Human Rights Council, and it involves all sorts of countries. Countries that are considered human rights abusers, countries that are considered Western countries. And that's just the nature of the United Nations. I mean, the United States has been saying for a while that we want to sort of purge the council of human rights abusers, but it, in many ways that's unrealistic. But what's really interesting is that the council itself isn't so much activists as much as the mandate holders that are created by the councils. So the council itself is made up of member states that generally are much more socially conservative than people would actually think. But who are really progressive is the bureaucracy that the Human Rights Council empowers, and they are very aggressive in promoting abortion and LGBT rights.
Well, they do happen to be outside the United Nations as well as inside the United Nations, very, very aggressive in pushing agenda. And that's why so many people feel bullied into either being quiet or accepting the agenda as, well, this is kind of a done deal. And people in power, the power brokers, are now, you know, accepting it and promoting it. And so I think I'll just have to go along with the system, that kind of thing. Not all together, and there is pushback by other countries. We'll talk about that. Where's the pushback coming from at the United Nations? We'll talk about that next.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Getting you connected. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logvinas, in for Drew. He'll be back at the end of the week, taking a few days off, as we all need to do. And I'm talking with my guest, Stefano Generini, Vice President for the Center of Legal Studies at the Center for Family and Human Rights, CFAM, which you can find online at c-fam.org. You can find their reports, their writing, their analysis, all very well written there about what's going on at the United Nations, which we should be very concerned about. That's a world body, and therefore what comes out of there as decided policy will affect large swaths or sometimes just whole countries of the world that didn't have that policy before, might have rejected it, might have resisted it. But there are very aggressive efforts going on there to change policies in other countries with things like abortion and LGBT issues. And it's been a back and forth battle for a long time now. And there are very aggressive, powerful forces pushing for this and activating and agitating for these changes. So on that note, Stefano, I said that I would ask you when we came back. I asked you just before, a little bit ago, what countries are on the Human Rights Council? How many? And you said, oh my, there are 48 member states. And without naming them all, 48, that's a lot of 48 member states of the world. So now to this question, was there any pushback from any country on what the Human Rights Council was doing most recently on this meeting and the agenda promoted to being dominated by abortion and LGBT agenda?
So there were several. There's always a lot of pushback, especially when the council negotiates agreements. So the way these deliberative bodies work is according to parliamentary procedures, which anybody who's familiar with a boardroom or any legislature would understand. Parliamentary procedures are rules according to which any deliberative body adopts an agreement. And so there are generally negotiations before these agreements are proposed for adoption. And during those negotiations, there's always a conflict on the social issues between the progressive countries, which are generally the United States, the European, and, you know, members of the European Union, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, most of the English-speaking world. And on the other side, of course, there are countries that have more socially conservative mores around sexuality, including Arab countries, sometimes countries from Latin America, although it's increasingly rare, as well as many countries from Africa, which have very traditional family values. And so those are pretty much the two lines along which this culture war is being played out at the United Nations. But of course, all the power is on one side. It's on the side of the donors, the European Union and the United States, which between themselves fund, about 60% and upward of 60% of all the UN budget.
Well, it's wow. That's a lot. People should care about this. It is very important, I feel. Tell us about that. I think that some of these member states, small as they are, would really be appealing to someone as powerful as the United States to help them end this aggressive push for them to accept things that are to them, as you brought up Africa for one, totally unacceptable policies. I remember after Pope Francis said this, one of the African bishops stood up at a, I don't know if it was a conference they were holding, and he literally said, use the same language as Pope Francis. He said, we don't want your ideological colonization here. And Pope Francis refer to that ideological colonization. That seems to be what's happening, and especially at the United Nations with pushes against nations or pushes towards nations to tie what maybe LGBT agenda to foreign aid. Now that's government, and I know you, Stefano, have written about government. You have a headline, President Biden promises to scrap federal pro-life laws before the Human Rights Council. So I know these member nations, the smaller ones or the ones that feel overwhelmed by the big Western countries, they really need help pushing back against that. Are they getting that help? And now they see the United States president promising to scrap federal pro-life laws before the UN Human Rights Council. So what's the climate like there for this back and forth?
Well, you can imagine. I mean, you'd be surprised how many countries would be really happy to see the United States promote pro-family initiatives around the world,
mm-hmm.
And policies that are friendly to the family instead of trying to promote, Western sexual mores, which fragment the family and isolate individuals and sort of promote this individualist culture that, has in many ways has wrecked our own society in many parts. And so, but sadly, countries find themselves instead on the receiving end of these policies, of these destructive policies, and they can only do so much, as I said, because in many regards, they do come to the United Nations with their hands outstretched for international assistance. I'm thinking especially of many countries in Africa and East Asia who are very much in need of international assistance for all sorts of needs, ranging from food security to humanitarian assistance, help in developing infrastructure. And they come to these international fora, the United Nations, the World Bank, with their hands outstretched. And they don't feel many times that they're the ones who are able to dictate what the conditions for the aid are, because they are on the receiving end. It is the Western countries who are the ones who dictate the conditions for the foreign assistance. And the Western countries are becoming more and more aggressive. I don't know if you noticed what the European Commission has been doing, but the European Commission, which is the most powerful organ of the European Union, They have now launched a strategy to promote LGBT rights globally, including through their international assistance and through the United Nations. But they're having to deal with Poland, Hungary internally first. So they want to get them on board first, but at the same time they are already pressuring countries tremendously to promote LGBT issues at all levels. From UN policy, UN negotiations, to maternal health issues, to HIV/AIDS issues, and even in the collection of data and vital statistics, they are trying to sneak in the LGBT agenda, trying to allow for different genders and sexual orientations to be to put for data on different genders and sexual orientations to be collected by statistical offices in Africa, of all places.
Wow. So I know we're wrapping up here, but this is sort of a question, and it's sort of just kind of repeating back what I hear you saying, because I was going to ask you, are UN officials emphasizing sexual rights, whether it's abortion or LGBT things, to the detriment of issues like, eliminating hunger and malnutrition? You just named maternal health among them. I mean, it's to the detriment of those issues that these other ones are getting so much attention.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'll just give you the example, for example, of violence against women. You know, we've had violence against women policies in the United States for over 50 years, and they've been very effective in curbing violence against women. But internationally, sadly, the United States and through the United Nations, we are promoting a completely different agenda that from violence against women. We're promoting something called gender-based violence. It's a completely different idea. We're not talking about ending impunity. We're not talking about helping victims and punish perpetrators. Instead, we're talking about changing social norms. So we're really distracting governments from really what they need to do to end violence against women instead and promoting transformative gender change or gender norms, which essentially means the LGBT agenda instead of a women's agenda.
Well, Stefano, you're the one who brings our attention to this, and we ran out of time before I could ask you about your column. Really well done. Fear of losing is costing conservatives the culture wars. We should save that for another time because that's got an important message in it. For those who feel like, I don't know, in the pro-life world, in the pro-family and marriage culture world, they feel like they're losing, but you're saying, well, take a look at what you're doing. I mean, or not doing. And that's an important message as well. But Stefano, thank you for bringing us support. Thank you all at CFAM. I know you're a small staff, but you're mighty. And people, we really want to call on people to support the work you do, because c-fam.org, c-fam.org, you can find Stefano's writings and others on their team. They are small but mighty. And thank you for all you do and for coming in and talking today. Thanks, Stefano.
Thank you, Sheila.
We really need to get behind these issues and these people and give them our support. Prayers for everyone. Thank you.